Hello, Bill Scher.
Good morning, Matt Lewis.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. It is a we're talking in the morning, so that's good. So I have my A game here, and it's been beautiful, beautiful week here in DC. The weather could not be better, so I'm happy to be here with you, Bill Scher.
I'm surprised it's good weather. It's a little sticky up north. I thought if it's sticky up here, it's usually brutal down there.
Well, it's been cooler and less humid than normal. We're used to a lot of heat and humidity, and it's starting to feel like summer. But it's been a great week, except, Bill, I have to say, we did stir up a little bit of a hornet's nest last week right here in the DMZ.
Well, I blame the Blogging It social media team. You know, they set us up for a fall there.
I know some people were saying that, but honestly, I felt like they tweeted something we talked about, and I thought it was totally valid what they tweeted. I don't think it misrepresented our conversation.
No, I don't think it was misrepresentative, but it was provocatively described.
Well, that's the point of tweeting, right? Get people to click on the links. I mean, you have to tease them a little bit. Now, we were criticized because I'm guessing it's hard for me to get into the mind of the left here. Your friends, but we were criticized, I think, because we, two white men, dared to talk about this issue that was hot at the time last week. I mean, two or three scandals ago, about basically, it was in the wake of the Santa Barbara shooting, mass shooting, and we were talking about, you know, the sort of general attacks on white men that frankly have been well documented, including Anne Hornaday's blaming of Judd Apatow. And there was some pushback on Twitter. What do you think sparked it specifically?
Well, you know, the tweet, we had a pretty wide-ranging discussion about the yes, all women response to the Vista shooting, part of which was, your take that this had a negative backlash towards over blaming men for things. Is that a fair characterization of your view?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a piece, a very controversial piece at the week, called something to the effect of a defense of old white men.
And which you wrote after our discussion.
Yeah, it went up after our discussion. But that piece was very controversial, and there were some people even who dared to call it a racist rant. And I would say to them, find me any one sentence or whatever, anything that I wrote in that piece that is in any way inappropriate or mean-spirited, whatever. And nobody could do it. There was literally nothing that anybody could find that was written that was in any way offensive, except the concept. The concept itself was somehow offensive. The notion that, like, we shouldn't be attacking any group of people, you know, and blaming, sort of generally casting aspersions on people based on, you know, race or gender. That has become a controversial thing somehow.
Well, so before we get into that in more depth, so the tweet went out that described our conversation as is, you know, hashtag yes all women unfair to men, and when Blogging has tweeted that out, I believe initially as Anna Marie Cox of the original Wonkette, retweeted that and said Jesus Christ in response, and that triggered a whole bunch of commentary. You know, where do two guys get off even talking about this conversation? You know, just what the world needs, you know, two men talking about what's going on with women's lives, which I might add was how I start off the entire conversation.
Right. We started off joking about that. And look, I mean, frankly, I think a few things about this. Number one, I think it's funny that Anna Marie Cox, who, like, didn't seem to have much of a problem going on Don Imus' show for years, finds us offensive. Second, I think that I think it's offensive to say that certain people shouldn't be allowed to talk about certain things. So, for example, we're going to talk about this, you know, POW/deserter, presumably at some point. Well, I don't feel like I have to have served in the military to have an opinion about that or to be able to voice a valid opinion, right? And And I feel like I can talk about defending the right to life, even though I'm obviously never going to become pregnant. I don't think I have to live in a border state for me to be, you know, I've actually had this because, you know, I'm pro-immigration reform. I've had people say, but you don't live on a border state, so you have no right to talk about this. So, like, I reject the notion that you have that two white guys can't have a discussion about it. And by the way, we talk about everything. It's not like the Republican Party decided to select us to represent them on national TV as the most important voices on this very important topic. We have a show and we talk about whatever's happening that week. And I don't think our opinions should be discounted based on who we are.
I basically agree with that. I mean, obviously, I participated in the conversation. I thought that people were, I mean, and this is the way of Twitter, of course. People didn't wait to listen to the entire conversation and then decide to tweet about it. They just reacted to the tweet that blogging heads did. And a lot of the thrust of it was, you know, where do these two guys, you know, get off who needs to hear women's voices? And of course, nothing that we did, having our own little tiny sliver of online platform in this world, was crowding out the many legitimate and important voices in this discussion. And bloggers themselves had a two-woman discussion on the subject already. So
yeah, it's not a zero-sum game where because right. you and I talked about it, somebody else didn't get their big shot to have this discussion. But I have to say, Bill, and I don't mean to be a hack and to try to score political points, but this does strike me as not terribly surprising. I feel like that there are this sort of proves my point, actually, that white men are not considered, you know, to be valid or worthy of having or expressing an opinion on this topic. So, I feel like there is a strain of the left and of the feminist movement that has become very angry. Now, Alyssa Rosenberg, a friend of mine at the Washington Post, wrote a piece about this, pushing back at me. And it seems like the argument comes down to white men have had it so good for so long, it's about time they get a taste of their medicine. Now, she wrote her piece. I know she does blogging hits sometimes. I may even have her on my podcast to discuss this further, so I don't want to put words in her mouth, but that's my interpretation. I get the sense that that it's not about healing. It's not about bringing people together. It is about revenge for something that you and I have never done. And I'm going to say it, though, I think we're both, in our own way, civil rights champions here. And yet, we have been lumped in with these, you know, with every other aging white male. So there.
Well, just to be clear, I don't agree with the piece you wrote on the week. I don't agree with...
What do you disagree with? What is there to disagree with?
Well, I'll get there. Okay. And I don't agree with you know, your side of the discussion that we had last week, as I said at the time. But I do think that you know, the discussion to be had about privilege, about ignorance of women's experiences, about the mansplaining phenomenon, all that kind of stuff. Which I think is important discussion to be had. That gets taken too far when you say you shouldn't have the discussion at all if you are a white man. That to me is an overbroad, unnecessary place to take the discussion. Obviously, if we were crowding out other voices, that would be a problem. I think, you know, even though I disagree with you on this subject, I thought it was a valuable conversation to have to draw out what your view is, so perhaps we can find where there actually might be some underlying common ground. Maybe someone's view can be changed and you have a better understanding where where that other side is coming from. That's the whole point of the show. And we try not to talk past each other in the process. And so when you just see the tweet and say, I'm not even going to listen to this because of what the how this is being characterized in 100 characters, you know, I think that is a problem. And I think it feeds, you know, what I think it feeds your wrong notion about this whole discussion. But understandably, because you're literally being, marginalized in that moment. I don't think you're being marginalized writ large. I don't think white men are being marginalized writ large. But when you have a moment like that, I can understand why someone takes it.
Let me get a little edgy here, Bill. This will push it, but I think I'm within my bounds. But I think this will illustrate my point. I think there is a double standard, and I think the question is it okay to have a double standard? But the question is not, is there a double standard? And I'll give you my example. In Anne Hornaday's column at the Washington Post, and she's a film critic, she's the one who got in controversy for talking about Judd Apatow. She, you know, in quotes, used the term white men and was talking about how white men controlled Hollywood and implied that because white men had controlled Hollywood for so long that their sort of misogyny had spread to a lot of films. What if she had said that about Jewish people, of which Judd Apatow, I believe, is? Would the Washington Post have published it if she had talked about that Judd Apatow being Jewish and that somehow misogyny had spread because they control Hollywood? I mean, this is what she was saying about white men. My point is she couldn't have. And I'm glad she couldn't have, because that would have certainly been anti-Semitic. So why is it okay for her to single out white men and to allege that they control this grand cabal of controlling Hollywood and their, you know, misogynistic attitudes are coming out in films? Is that?
Well, I mean, this is where I diverge with you. It's probably in the current, well, I don't know. There, you still have a situation in Hollywood where, black directors are doing better. Women directors are doing better, but you're still talking pretty small numbers all around. You still have a pretty massive discrepancy in, you know, white people of color ratio and male female ratio. Extremely few have gotten Oscar nominations, you know, but it's moving in a positive direction. But there's a lot of legitimate discussion to be had about how does this impact the content of what you see? Are there subtle things that we talked about last week about the Bechdel test? You know, are you not having healthy portrayals of women in films because not enough women are directors? And we just had the recent example of Frozen, now a big hit, because it had a woman director and it had scenes in it where you did that flipped the idea of the strapping male hero saving the woman in distress. All the major scenes in that, the woman ends up saving the man in distress. Would you have had a movie like that if there wasn't a woman co-director? I think there are some legitimate, concrete examples of things to talk about. Whereas when you talk about, you know, Jewish control, it's just not factually accurate. You know, just because there's some statistical, disproportionate to the percentage of the country of Jews in Hollywood, that has nothing to do with the content of the films or the ability for other religions to become directors. Christians can become directors in Hollywood,
right? But I would say a couple things. One, I think, you know, there's a real legitimate argument about diversity of people, you know, opinion leaders or whatever. And, you know, that's a legitimate discussion, but I think it's separate from this. I think whether or not, whether or not it's factually correct of Jews controlling Hollywood, to me is irrelevant. Because nobody's saying, I don't agree with that trope because it's factually incorrect. People are rightly saying, I disagree with that trope because it's offensive and racist. My point is, it's perfectly okay to say something about white men generally. controlling Hollywood and spreading this misogynistic, you know, viewpoint that you couldn't say about any other ethnic or gender. You just couldn't. You couldn't say because X people control X industry, they're producing something bad. You just couldn't get away with it. It would be politically incorrect.
By approaching the issue, I mean, you're approaching the issue in this way, I think you're shutting down the kind of discussion that, as someone who doesn't like political correctness, you generally say you don't want to shut down. I mean, there's a discussion to be had about the portrayals of women and the portrayals of people of color in popular culture. You know, it has an impact about how we see ourselves. I mean, I have an issue right now. This is not about movies. You know, my daughters are very interested in, particularly my oldest daughter, in the presidents. You know, we have these sort of presidential pets books, and we talk about the presidents and the dogs they have. And as we're reading it, she's asking me, why are there no girl presidents? That's really, really frustrating to me. I've been trying really hard to show her lots of good role models and all things.
Let me tell you, Margaret Thatcher, my friend, would be a great
Well, actually, it made me think about, you know, what could I actually do my own little, you know, makeshift book with women leaders in other countries just to show that there are women leaders in other countries. But it's really awful that I can't do that with my own country.
You may be able to soon.
Exactly, but that's obviously it's not Hollywood, it's not fiction, it's nonfiction. It is what it is. But it's a problem as far as trying to explain that you can be whatever you want to be.
I totally agree. Before these are the kind of things I actually thought about. I did, you know, before I knew I was going to have boys. You know. Even thought about the name Benazir as a potential name, and I agree that's a totally legitimate discussion, and you know we would probably agree if that were the discussion. I think this is a separate discussion, but I think you're making a point. I do want to say I think speaking of common ground, that somebody wrote something that I tweeted yesterday that I thought was common ground, and it's going to this check your privilege line, which I think has become an insult and a way of shutting down discussion. And this guy was saying, it should be check your blessings. And I think count your blessings is better. So, like, you know, I think it's totally appropriate for me, regardless of my ethnicity and gender, to count my blessings and to say, you know, look, my dad was a prison guard, but I have it pretty good, and I have certain blessings, and I should be aware that not everyone has all the blessings that I have, and I should be cognizant of that, and I should be introspective about that, and that should help inform me when I talk about even public policy. This is not a new. You know, Rawls has talked about this sort of thing. Adam Smith talked about this sort of thing. But sort of putting yourself in other folks' shoes, I think it's totally fine and totally legitimate. I wish that it was count your blessings instead of check your privilege.
Well, I think there is a unhealthy dynamic where people try to, you know, win debates by claiming a certain inherent superiority or victimhood, depending on the context. This is not just about women versus men or people of color versus whites. I mean, it can be my father had a working class background. I didn't have a silver spoon in my mouth. Therefore, I know more about this than you do. Or you're a coastal elite, and I'm from the deep south, and I know more about what real America is like than you. I mean, I think there's all sorts of ways that people try to trump others and shortcut a debate and not have the full debate on the merits, which is not healthy. But I do think this the check your privilege and the mansplaining themes do come from a legitimate frustration that certain people can be very condescending when they're explaining things and try to shut down debate that way. And that's a way, I mean, it may be a two wrongs not make a right situation, but it's a way to say, hey, you know, shut up for a second and listen to somebody else with a different perspective for once. But we need more just sort of general patience and listening. And I actually go back to, you know, Obama's More Perfect Union speech for the 2008 campaign, where I think which gets trivialized as being just about politics now. Particularly because Obama did not, you know, engage in sort of larger racial conversation as president. But I do think that the crux of that speech is actually very important, where he says, look, we should not stop listening to a person like Jeremiah Wright because he says offensive things sometimes, nor should we stop listening to a white person who might say offensive things sometimes. Because if we just stop listening to them and deride them and box them out, we're not going to get to what the larger understandings and common ground is. You know, we need to find a way to actually sit down and actually have the conversation.
Or at least listen to us who don't say offensive things. I mean, you know, I think we're within the bounds of respectability, I hope. I think we both kind of piss off people on all sides of the spectrum. And I guess we've talked too much about this. I know we just wanted to talk briefly about it, and but now we're 20 minutes into it, so we should probably move on. There's a lot of ground to cover. We could go the fun direction, or we can go the serious direction. It's you're driving the ship, Bill Scherer.
Well, I want to go in the selfish direction.
Okay,
talk about myself.
That's good. I like that.
So. So right after we had our last show, I had a piece published at Politico. It was my first Politico op-ed in the Politico magazine section, which got titled The Liberal Case for the NSA, which I actually think was a little bit of an overbroad title because I only talked about one aspect of the NSA. I actually was not talking about the counterterrorism aspect. I wrote a piece about that in the week a year ago. But I was talking about their history in forging peace and expanding freedom, which essentially is about the political intelligence mission of the NSA. And I got interested in doing that, one, because I stumbled across it as I was reading about the history of the UN, and I thought it was history that people, and the NSA's role in it, people just didn't know about, so I wanted to talk about it. And also in terms of the whole Greenwald-Snowden debate, you know, both Glenn Greenwald and Ed Snowden routinely make the case that what the NSA is doing is not really about terrorism. And then they'll cite an example like, well, we're tapping Angela Merkel's phone, the German chancellor. We intercepted conversations from the Brazilian president or the Mexican president. Aha, this proves this is about spying for spying's sake, grab American hegemonic position. It's not about terrorism at all. And I think the evidence shows that there are two separate missions here. I mean, there is a counterterrorism mission. There's a separate political intelligence mission that goes back much longer than the counterterrorism mission. And it's not an illegitimate mission. It's not just trying to crush smaller countries. It's about actually trying to achieve important global interest goals.
Right. I mean, you cite examples where the forerunner to the NSA used eavesdropping to help put American diplomats in a more advantageous negotiating position with the United Nations and other things like that.
Well, I mean, I think advantageous is not even quite the right word. I mean, this came up in Greenwald's book, The Most No Place to Hide. He one of the few scoops in the book is he has documents showing that our UN ambassador at the time, Susan Rice, directed the NSA to spy on a number of the UN Security Council members to help them win the resolution that put international sanctions on Iran. for not coming clean on its nuclear enrichment program. And it's described in the book as, you know, America trying to win advantage, you know, over other countries. And it's not about just winning. I mean, it's also about trying to find the way to compromise so you get something. It's not about trying to negate what concerns other countries have. It's trying to find out what those concerns are so you can craft a resolution that's for everybody's liking. You know, we didn't get the perfect UN resolution on Iran. We had to compromise, and it was actually weaker sanctions than we might have otherwise liked. We wanted to make sure that Russia and China stayed on board. With the UN, and this was, you know, technically not the NSA, it was the precursor to the NSA, the United States Army Signal Security Agency. There was a big UN conference in San Francisco in the spring of 1945, and we basically spied on pretty much every delegation that was coming to find out, okay, what are they saying privately that they aren't saying to us? What are their real concerns? What are their real red lines? It's exactly the same formulation that Susan Rice used in these NSA memos about the Iran resolution. And there were a number of very sticky conflicts that could have sunk the conference. There was a question whether Argentina should be admitted to the UN. Argentina was Nazi-friendly. The Soviet Union was adamantly opposed to them being admitted, but the Latin American bloc was adamant that they were admitted. And if the Latin American countries walked, they would have blown up the conference. So that was a very tricky thing to navigate. There was an issue about whether a five-nation security council would have a broad veto. A lot of the smaller countries were upset about that. France was actually choosing not to even be part of the Security Council. They were rebuffing the offer because they were feeling they weren't being respected properly as a big five nations. They were siding with the smaller countries. We ramped up the flattery of France in response to make sure that we could win them back over, knowing that if they side with the smaller nations, they'd blow up the veto and blow up the conference. So that's what it was used for. And another big question where it comes into compromise territory is the question of decolonization. You know, we wanted to have the UN, you know, have a council that would move colonies towards independence. Britain and France and the Netherlands were quite much against that. And you know, we didn't just win the argument. We had to split the difference and say, okay, in the section about this, we'll use independence broadly, but we won't use it in the section about dependent peoples. We'll say self-determination, not independence. But that still led to the almost total decolonization of the world. This is the words of Stephen Schlesinger, who wrote the book on this whole subject called Act of Creation, which is how the UN was formed. It's a fantastic book. So we had to forge a compromise, and we didn't know we had to form a compromise because of the intel we were getting, because we were spying on people. And so we know a lot about that story. We know less about another big case, which is the Camp David Accords, because the intelligence about that only was just released in this past November. And it was heavily redacted, so it actually didn't spell out what the NSA did. But there was a panel discussion at the Carter Center on the same day where one of the CIA analysts said that, yes, we were getting intercepts from the NSA and the CIA on the subject. So we know a little bit about that. And Jimmy Carter himself gave an indication what was in there, because he knew that he had to keep Sadat and Begin, the Egyptian and Israeli prime heads of state, apart. They weren't in the same room at all during Camp David because of the personal profiles the CIA had gotten on them. And they knew that most of the delegations, the people in the delegations, Sadat and Begin didn't even trust at all. And so they knew not to work with them and to work with stuff, only certain... I'm sorry?
It's interesting. This hit home with me. I was watching it. Have you seen this History Channel's World Wars special?
I saw the ads about it, but I didn't actually see the film.
Really good. You know, it's basically like Hitler in World War I, and then Hitler in World War II, Churchill, Stalin, Patton. They're showing their involvement in World War I and World War II. And one of the things that they really stressed was the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, obviously, everybody knows that Germany... because of the, sort of harsh terms, they were forced to pay whatever.
Reparations.
Reparations. Thank you. I have to bring you with me everywhere I go to help finish the sentences I can't think of. So anyway, everybody knows that Germany, like, that was a problem that helped lead to the rise of fascism. But I think less known is that Italy, because they were, you know, they were on the winning side, but they didn't get much out of the deal, that led to the rise of Mussolini, and that Japan, which was also on the winning side, felt slighted and mistreated during the negotiations and the meetings, that sort of inspired them to go the direction that they went in World War II. So it really hit home, that this point that you're making about how, you know, what happens in these negotiations. It's not just the terms themselves, but all sorts of variables. You know, if someone had known what would happen because of the Treaty of Versailles, you could have maybe prevented World War II.
Right. And, you know, maybe if they had an NSA back in those days, they would have, Woodrow Wilson basically did almost all the work himself. I mean, it was just this Herculean job that he took on, where you're trying to solve every single problem in the world all by yourself. And there's lots of hard compromises that had to be made, and that had negative consequences at the end of the day.
Right. You know, if you had a tape of the Japanese saying, hey, we're being disrespected here.
Right.
We're going
to
have to go it alone. We're going to have to ramp up our own military to get any respect. I mean, who knows if that was said, but that, you know, if you had that sort of tape, it maybe then you cut them in a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it informs your negotiation strategy. I mean, it's like any, you go into a meeting, you ask around, what are you hearing?
I mean,
you know, what's the word on the
street? I secretly tape everybody before I meet with, you know, just in case.
Right.
So.
So these are legitimate purpose. I you may not agree, Matt, but as I make the case in my piece, the UN has made the world less bloody. We don't have world wars anymore. We have dramatically fewer war related deaths today than in 1950. I point you people to the Human Security Report, which lays out these numbers and makes the case how the UN has played a major part in the reduction of violence, and there's the decolonization aspect where the world is freer now because of this. So the NSA, in that respect, has done a lot of good. This doesn't negate other things they might have done that are bad, but it doesn't mean that we delegitimize the entire operation. So I write this piece, and I get asked on to MSNBC's Up, the Steve Kornacki show on the weekends. And I learned 24 hours, my lesson 24 hours in advance, that I'm going to be debating Snowden's lawyer at the ACLU, Ben Wisner, one-on-one on the whole subject. So that clip, you can find the clip also on MSNBC.com. It's also, I put it up on liberaloasis.com. So you know, we had an interesting discussion, and I don't know if you got to saw it, Matt. It got some attention because towards the end of it, we're discussing whether Snowden should get a harsh sentence or not. Should he be allowed to come home and, you know, not serve a sentence, serve a light sentence? And I made the point, you know, they're making this case that he would not be treated in the same way that Dan Ellsberg got treated. Dan Ellsberg, who did the Pentagon Papers, you know, when he was charged, he was free on bail. He got to give political speeches. He ended up getting off on a technicality because of abuses that the Nixon administration did. They're saying, well, you know, if Snowden gets treated like Chelsea Manning and is in solitary confinement and never can see the light of day and gets a life sentence or a Larry Long sentence and can't speak to the world anymore, you know, that's not what they did to Ellsberg. And I'm not arguing for a life sentence for Snowden necessarily, but as I put out on the show, Ellsberg did not release anything about current military operations. Snowden released information about current counterterrorism operations. It's a decidedly different act that the two of them did, and that the Snowden team never wants to acknowledge. But then, and then towards the end of the discussion, Ben Wisner was arguing, you know, would you have wanted, you know, Dan Ellsberg to serve a life sentence? Would you have wanted the people on the Underground Railroad to serve a life sentence?
Steve
Kornacki, you know, just lit it. I mean, at that point, I got kind of shoved to
the
side.
Well, the funny part is after Kornacki pushed back on that, then the lawyer quit comparing Snowden to the Underground Railroad and switched to comparing him to Martin Luther King Jr.
Which is really strange because Martin Luther King spent time in jail.
I mean, that's the whole letter from a Birmingham jail, civil right. disobedience. That's the whole. But Kornacki pointed that out. That's sort of the.
I just find the whole thing weird because, I mean, I was talking to Wisner before the show. He's a top guy at the ACLU. He clearly is an accomplished attorney and is very well composed and knows his stuff. And as you say, he wasn't trying to make a literal comparison. I understand people make parallels at times and aren't trying to speak literally, but just a dumb parallel to make because it just sets you up for that kind of response. And then they use the hypothetical of Martin Luther King when. He was trying to say, what if King did not stay in Birmingham and went to New York? Would you then say he deserves a life sentence? But he didn't do that.
I knew Martin Luther King Jr. He was a good friend of mine. You're no Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, it's the same thing that Dan Quayle tried. I mean, those comparisons are dangerous. And if, you know what, I think it works if you don't get caught on it. So he didn't get away with it this time.
Less than ideal for me is that he just before then he had made the argument that he had said this is not really about terrorism, and I said it's that dismissive attitude about terrorism that he and Snowden and Greenwald make, which is why when Snowden says I have not hurt counterterrorism operations by this leak, I don't take your word for that because you keep telling me that terrorism is not really what's going on here. And I point out that I think Snowden actually was being disingenuous in last week's interview because he said, I take the threat of terrorism very seriously. And that's not what he said a year ago when he did one of his early interviews after being unveiled, where he said, this can't really be about terrorism because American police kill more Americans than terrorists do. That's not an attitude about being taken terrorism seriously. Wisner would even said it a little differently and said, this is not about terrorism. If you think it is, you're a sucker. This is about diplomatic espionage. It's about economic espionage. And so I had this moment where I was actually going to talk about the Politico article, but then he stepped in the Underground Railroad, and that was the end of the interview. So,
I think a couple things. One, you had a great week this week because you had a great piece in Politico magazine. You had a piece in Real Clear Politics. Yes. And then you go on up with Kornacki. I think the way to view it, so you had a great week. And I think you are becoming very well positioned as sort of the go-to voice of a certain brand of what Jonah Goldberg might call liberal fascism. We've talked about this before. I mean, this thing that you're doing now, and I love how you incorporate history into these arguments, showing this sort of tradition that you're on the side of the tradition of liberalism in America. Your piece in the New York Times a couple summers ago about how liberals should work with / co-op big business is very consistent, I think, with this argument, which is that liberals should work with / utilize the military industrial complex, essentially.
We have Tim Carney, who's on the libertarian right and going at crony capitalism and the intersection between progressives and big business is his beat. He did a piece about that again last week when he cited my New York Times piece that I jokingly tweeted back, I'm proud to be in the liberal fascism canon. putting me in the liberal fascism canon. And he said, you're the most cogent defender of the progressive corporate state.
Absolutely. And right now you have this benefit. I think it's a benefit. Maybe it's not helpful. But your sort of worldview is very much coinciding with defending Obama. But I don't think it's just that you're reflexively defending Obama. I think you actually do have this coherent, old school, I don't know how you describe it, liberal, big government liberalism that is very much at odds with the Glenn Greenwalds of the world. And I would just end my little statement here by saying that's the other good thing that came from being on Up with Kornacki, aside from the fact that you, I don't think, really got to talk about your Politico piece as much as you should have. You at least got into a little bit of a back and forth on Twitter with Greenwald, And yeah. You guys both, I think, on the left, I would argue, but both on diametrically opposed on a lot of stuff within the spectrum of liberal political opinion.
Well, you know, Greenwald, you know, saw the interview on MSNBC and said, you know, why is it that all these liberals, you know, started defending the NSA after January 20th, 2009, hashtag mysteries. And this is a general knock, you know, we're all Obama bots and we're changing our opinion about.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are, Bill. In fairness,
well,
you
can go back to, I'll say this, you go back to what I was writing in the Bush days. I did not write about the Patriot Act very much. You know, I was uncomfortable attacking Bush on those grounds. I thought it was a bad place for liberals to go to seem like we were not taking terrorism seriously. I wrote a little bit about the warrantless wiretapping because that was a pretty blatant violation of law. But I wasn't making a larger argument that we shouldn't be doing aggressive counterterrorism. I was mostly making the argument, as I responded to Greenwald, many of us were saying Bush was not prioritizing terrorism enough.
Yeah.
That was our prominent critique. And the interesting thing is,
I wonder if I'm closer to Greenwald than you are.
In certain respects, I think you are. I think you have a bit more of a libertarian attitude on some of these issues, which is a perfectly sound, opinion to have. But, Greenwald likes to make these very glib and oversimplified comments, assuming everyone on the left was saying the exact same thing in the Bush days, and now some of us flipped and some of us didn't. And that's just not the case. There were many of us who were saying, when Obama in 2008 saying we need to go after Pakistan hard if they don't go after Bin Laden, a lot of us said, good. And I've been making the case well before that Bush was not doing that. I'm not being inconsistent at all. I'm happy to see Obama take the military-industrial complex and direct it towards actual terrorism. That's what we're calling for
My point is, I think you have become one of the most effective proponents of this brand of liberalism, which is, I think you've written. This is like a sort of a suck up session, but I think I told you this when you wrote that New York Times piece. This is a book. I mean, I think you are sort of the guy making a defense of this kind of big government liberalism, and that you are sort of owning this brand. And that's a really cool place to be as an opinion leader, as a columnist, as a writer, to be like, at one of the people at the forefront of defending a philosophical tradition. And so I'm just happy to see you be able to do such good work exploiting it. And frankly, I kind of wish that you would get more attention for this, even though I may not agree with it. It's really cool.
I appreciate that. But I don't want this whole discussion to be about me as lovely as that is. Anything on your mind that you want to talk about before we wrap things up?
Well, look, everybody's going to talk about this POW swap. I don't think any two old white guys weighing in on that one.
Neither of us have ever been POWs, Matt, so how could we talk about it?
That's a good point. Deserter is a better... Well, deserters, a deserter for five terrorists.
Yeah, you know, he was never classified as a deserter by the military. There's a process for that, and he was never classified as a deserter.
Well, again, I'm not, because I never served, I shouldn't even be discussing this.
I'll quote Oliver North. I don't know if you saw my tweet yesterday. Oliver North said on Josh Gibson's radio show, people should stop speculating about Bergdahl. Let justice be served, and justice might exonerate him. That's Oliver North.
All right. Well, then I guess I shouldn't even be talking about it. What the hell right do I have to weigh in on this?
When have you illegally run arms to Nicaragua? What right do you have to talk about this subject?
You could just say that about anything. Well, let's see how this VA scandal plays out. It's too soon to weigh in. There's an IG investigate. I mean, you could say that. I get paid to talk about stuff, okay?
Oliver North, Oliver North in the interview did say, and I know something about the justice system.
I love to see how it plays out, Bill. Look, there's two. So instead of getting bogged down in something serious, I've got two sort of light things we could talk about quickly. I'll let you choose, Bill. One is what I learned from Tony Kornheiser about blogging every day. And the other is that it is the 30th, aside from being, by the way, much more significant as we speak, the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. It is also the 30th anniversary of the Born in the USA album. And so I'm very well prepared to talk about either of these.
The two of them make me feel old.
Old white guy you are.
And I guess blogging makes you feel old too. So I'm not sure because blogging is now an outdated form of communication. But why don't you? What did Tony Kornheiser have to say?
We'll end on this because I. People, you know, this applies to me as someone who I write, you know, I've been writing a column for the Telegraph every couple of weeks, and I write a column for the Week. I'm a contributing editor at the Week, and I write some of their speed reads. I contribute to that. And of course, I work at the Daily Caller where I blog every day. And so I need to come up with a lot of content. And it has occurred to me that on any given day, Joe Blow could probably do as good of a job as me. But that's not the point. And Tony Kornheiser yesterday, it was a tough day if you're a sports guy in Washington, D.C., because, you know, the Nats didn't play, the basketball playoffs hadn't begun, and the Redskins, you know, it's not football season. So on a third, you know, so Kornheiser on his ESPN radio show, yesterday being Tuesday, he goes on and he says, you know, a lot of people come up to me and they say, you know what? I like your radio show. I could do that radio show. And he says, and you know what? I say, I bet you could. I bet you could come in here on Monday and do a radio show just as good, maybe even better than me. And I bet you could even come in on Tuesday and Wednesday and do a radio show as good as me. But what are you going to do on Thursday? Because that's the fourth day and the adrenaline will have, you know, run out by then. What are you going to talk about on Thursday? And it struck me, and I've heard him say something like this before, that's the key, is so much of what we do, Bill, is not about being brilliant or talented on any given day. It's about longevity and endurance. And it's not like we have to write one column a week. I mean, and never mind, what do you do on day four? What do you do on year four? What do you talk about on year four when every day you have to show up and talk about something, write about something, have a new spin on something? And it's not just reporting. It's having a spin on an analysis, opinion, whatever. I blogged about this.
And you,
at the Daily
people
Call.
Should know this. I mean, you post what? 4 blog posts a day? Is that about right?
Well, I mean, I think if you spread out what I do in a given week, I probably blog 1 or 2 things every day at the Daily Caller, 1 or 2 things every day at the Week, and then I write a column every week for the Week, so that's much more intensive. And I've been writing a column every other week for the Telegraph for a while. And so that is a lot. I'm also working on a book proposal. There's also, like, I do a podcast where I interview a couple people a week. We do the DMZ. There's a lot of stuff. And don't get me wrong. Again, this is sort of like first world problems. You know, I can't complain about my job because it's freaking awesome and I love it. And I would say it's a privilege. I'm going to count my blessings here. I love what I do and I'm blessed to be able to do it. And I'm privileged to be able to do it. But it ain't easy. And I do think that people think, well, I could write a better blog post than that or a better column than that. And you know what? Maybe you could. You could probably show up today and, like, write the hell out of, you know, what's happening with this, you know, this POW swap, out of the Tiananmen Square anniversary. You could probably do that. But try doing it every single day or at least 5 days a week for a decade and tell me how it goes then.
And that kind of pace is a pace that, quite frankly, I've never done. You know, I've been blogging, you know, professionally for 7 years, and I was doing it non-professionally for 5 years before that. And I And from the get-go, when I was doing liberalvoices.com back in the day, back in 2002, my attitude was, I'm gonna write a column a day. I'm gonna consume the news all day. I'm gonna see what everyone else has said. I'll think of something else that people haven't said. I'll write 700 words on that. You know, I never did the, you know, short bursts, 6-7 quickie things. I'm not wired to think that way. I don't feel like my short thoughts are often that interesting. And that's been a disservice to me to do this professionally, because the people who are being hired right now are though you see these advertisements for, you know, entry level, mid level journalism position, and it's like, you know, produce 5 things a day. And I just don't do that well. And I'm even taking a step back now. Like, I want to spend a few months on a big piece on the NSA and its role in history. It's going to take me some time to do it and some time to pitch it. And I like what gets produced, but it's not a way to make a living, because you don't make a lot of money on pieces like that, if any. And so that's a part of the puzzle that, quite frankly, I've not really solved, because I just don't think I'm constituted to do that.
And you may be better off, I mean, not doing it. You know, I think different people have different callings. I don't necessarily think the trend for more content is necessarily good or better for journalism. And I certainly think there are people who can get by writing 1 or 2 things a week or less, and just having them sort of blow up and be break news or drive a conversation. So I'm not saying that the way I do it is the only way to do it. I do think that the industry is pushing people to provide more content. There are different ways that you can sort of – different metrics that you can have to define success. One of them, obviously, is the amount of traffic. One of them is sort of buzz. And one of them is just sort of the number of posts. Maybe one of the easiest to quantify is how many posts you do a day. But I think that there is a trend in the industry to force people to produce content that may be healthy. It may be unhealthy. I mean, in the case of Tony Kornheiser, he has a daily radio show that's like 2 hours every day. He literally has to show up and talk about something for 2 hours every day. Like, whether now, if it's Monday after a football Sunday, Monday's easy, you know. But what do you do on Thursday? And that's when you separate the pros from the amateurs, in my opinion. And I do think, you know, every week I have this thing where basically I try not to write on the weekends. So the weekends are sort of recharging my battery reading. I show up Monday and Tuesday. I usually hit it out of the park. Then I kind of hit a wall in the middle of the week where I go through like a little bit of a mild depression, a little bit of a mild writer's block. And then I rebound at the end of the week. And this has become a pattern recently of my writing. But I've tried to be able to balance the quick little hits with also doing what I believe to be important substantive columns and potentially a book. So to me, I view it the way that like an actor would view. You do like, you know, you do some like sort of, you know, art house flicks to satisfy the soul. And you do a couple of blockbusters, you know, to put money in the bank kind of thing.
Before we wrap up, I know we weren't planning to talk about this, but we've been talking Mississippi for a while. What's your take on what happened there last night?
It was, we don't know who won yet. I don't think we know if there's going to be a runoff yet. So
last time I'm just looking right now with 99.6% in, McDaniel 49.6, Cochran 48.9. So if that holds, it would be a runoff.
There'd be a runoff. I think conventional wisdom would say that that's really bad news for Cochran, that he's the incumbent, and if he didn't get above 50%, then what would lead you to believe he might now? On the other hand, we have seen examples where, for example, Orrin Hatch didn't meet the threshold at a convention to avoid a primary or a runoff or whatever, and he was still able to win a couple years ago. I mean, I think, honestly, you know, polling doesn't confirm this. I'll just say that. But my sense is that had it not been for that nursing home scandal we talked about a couple weeks ago, that McDaniel would have won outright.
You think that was a, I was going to ask you, did that help him get this far? Did it bring up all these ugly issues about Cochran and his relationships, which I think are totally legit and not scandalous, but other people might think differently. You think that McDaniel would have just won, gone over 50, and this pulled him back some?
Yeah, I have no proof of this, and there are plenty of smart people who disagree. But my sense is that there was, Cochran was running. It's just his lousy candidate. He told Dan Balls the other day, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something to the effect of, I didn't think I should run for re-election, but they said I should. It's like, who's that? Is this your campaign staff? The voices in your head? Your consultants? I mean, who are – like, that's not a reassuring thing. Molly Ball at The Atlantic wrote that she interviewed him for like a half hour, and then a half hour later he didn't recognize her. So he may be having some issues himself. He certainly hasn't been a great candidate. I think that the nursing home scandal engendered sympathy for him, gave him something, gave his campaign something to talk about. And my sense is, totally anecdotal, without having stepped foot in the state during this campaign, and without a smidgen of polling evidence to back me up. But my sense, my gut is that McDaniel had all the momentum and all the argument, and that this nursing home scandal froze the race for about 10 days. And I think it hurt. I think it helped Cochran by engendering sympathy for him, giving him a rationale for being reelected. That's my sense. Now, I guess that if I had to bet, now I think Cochran, because he didn't get the 50%, that would have been needed to avoid a runoff, I think you have to assume that Cochran now goes down in the runoff.
And does that, because some say McDaniel is so far to the right, this gives Democrats a shot. They've nominated Travis Childers. He's won in Mississippi before. He used to be a congressman. He's a pretty conservative Democrat. Knows his state well. Are some Republicans nervous that McDaniel is poised at this point?
I think that's overstated. I think it's highly unlikely that a Democrat will win in Mississippi. I think that's the kind of theory that's fun to float if you're a political writer who's in Washington, D.C., who wants to have something to write about. But I suspect that unless McDaniel were to utterly implode, this is, in fact, a safe Republican seat. And I do not, unless he implodes, I do not anticipate this being, a missed opportunity for Republicans to take back the Senate because they lose Mississippi or something. I think that's highly unlikely.
All right, you heard it here. Matt Lewis's clairvoyance always
more
comes
often
to...
right than wrong, I would say, which is
that should be your slogan.
Which is, I mean, that's like the most honest slogan, because I am wrong. Just, I'd say more often right than wrong. And probably more often right than a lie. I'm okay with that, too.
Well, I was going to talk to you, Mr. Lewis.
Good talking with you, Mr. Scher, and thank you all for watching us. Please tweet horrible things about us at DMZ Show. And we'll see you next week.
All right, take care.